but is a man who is about to take in hand great and populous cities, full of inhabitants and government, and the care of private, public, and sacred affairs, which one would not be wrong to call the art of arts and the science of sciences, going to weigh the exact test of truth against the unstable drift of the lot, having fled from it. The test of truth consists in convictions grounded in reason. Having contemplated all this in his soul, Moses, wisest of all, does not even mention office by lot, but resolved to introduce offices filled by vote. At any rate, he says, you shall appoint over yourself a ruler, not a foreigner, but one from among your brothers. Deuteronomy 17:15, making plain a voluntary choice and an unimpeachable scrutiny of the ruler, which the whole multitude, acting in agreement, will carry out. And God, too, the guarantor of everything beneficial to the community, adds his vote to seal the choice, since he takes the man to be a kind of representative of the race, as an eye represents the body. He sets out two reasons why one must not choose a foreigner for the office. One, so that he not amass a great quantity of silver, gold, and livestock, storing up great and altogether unjust wealth out of the poverty of his subjects. The other, so that he not uproot the nation from its own land for the sake of his private greed and force it to migrate, carried here and there in endless wandering, its hopes of acquiring greater goods left unfulfilled, in exchange for the loss of what it was already securely enjoying. For he supposed in advance, reasonably, that a man of the same tribe and kin, sharing in the intimacy that belongs to the highest kinship. And the highest kinship is one commonwealth, one law, and one God, to whom all who belong to the nation have been allotted, would never go wrong in the ways just described, but on the contrary, instead of displacing the inhabitants, would provide a safe return for those scattered in foreign lands, and instead of taking away the property of others, would give his own substance to those in need, making it common. From the day on which anyone enters office, he commands him to write out with his own hand a summary form of Deuteronomy containing all the laws, wishing what has been ordained to become fastened firmly to his soul. For from one who merely reads, the thoughts slip away, swept off by the current. But for one who writes at leisure, they are stamped and firmly settled, since the mind takes its own time over each point and rests upon it, not moving on to the next before it has firmly grasped the one before. Once he has written it, however, let him try to consult and read it every day, for the sake of a continuous, uninterrupted memory of the good ordinances that benefit everyone, and so that a firm love and longing for them may take root in him, his soul being continually taught and habituated to converse with sacred laws. For long familiarity produces an unfeigned and pure friendship, not only toward people, but also toward forms of writing worthy of love. And this will come about if the ruler studies not another's writings and notes, but the ones he himself has written, for each person's own possessions are somehow more familiar to him and more readily called to mind. And besides, as he reads, he will at the same time reason with himself in something like these terms. I wrote these things, I, such a ruler, without making use of anyone else, though I had countless attendants at my service. Was it so that I might fill up a book, like men who write for hire, or like those who train eye and hand, the one for keenness of sight, the other for speed in writing? Not at all. It was so that, in writing these things into a book, I might at once transcribe them into my soul and stamp upon my mind characters more divine and indelible. Other kings carry staffs and bear scepters, but for me the scepter is the book of Deuteronomy, a boast and a glory beyond rivalry, the emblem of a rule beyond reproach, modeled on its archetype, the kingship of God. Ever leaning and resting upon the sacred laws, I shall acquire the two best things of all. First, equality, than which no greater good can be found, for arrogance and haughtiness belong to a small-minded soul that does not foresee the future. Equality, then, will produce the goodwill and security that come from subjects who repay just returns in kind, while inequality produces the most treacherous dangers. These I shall flee, hating inequality, patron of darkness and of wars, and I shall have a life free from plots by honoring untroubled equality, which begets light and stability. And I shall secure a second thing besides, not to tip the scale to one side, as on a balance, by twisting and distorting what has been ordained. But I shall try to guide these things along the highway of the middle course, keeping to straight and even steps toward a share in a life free from stumbling. Moses is accustomed to call the middle way the royal road, since it lies on the border between excess and deficiency, and also because, within a triad, the middle position has been allotted the leading rank, fitting together what lies on either side into a unity by an unbreakable bond, by which, indeed, it is escorted like a king by his bodyguard. Of the lawful ruler who honors equality, who cannot be bribed, who judges just things justly, Deuteronomy 16, 20, who continually practices the laws, he says that the reward is long-lasting rule. Not so that a long life should be granted him together with presiding over public affairs, but so that he may teach those who do not know it that the lawful ruler, even should he die, lives on for ages through his deeds, which he has left behind as immortal, indestructible monuments of nobility. It befits the man deemed worthy of the highest and greatest office to choose successors who will share his rule, share his judging, and jointly administer whatever else serves the common good. For one man alone would not suffice, however eager and however robust in both body and soul, for the magnitude and multitude of affairs, worn out by the flood of matters pouring in day after day from every quarter, unless he had helpers at his side, all chosen for excellence in wisdom, capability, justice, piety, and in not merely avoiding but hating, as an enemy and the greatest evil, arrogance. For such men would prove the helpers and supporters best fitted to lighten and ease the burden for a good and noble man weighed down by public affairs. And besides, since some matters are greater and others smaller, he would rightly entrust the lesser ones to his subordinates, so as not to be worn down over trifles, while for the greater matters he himself would necessarily become the most exacting examiner. One must suppose the great matters to be, not what some think. When men of reputation contend against men of reputation, the rich against the rich, rulers against rulers, but rather the opposite, when private individuals, the poor, and the obscure contend against the more powerful, for whom the judge is their one hope of suffering nothing beyond remedy. Clear examples of each of these can be found in the sacred laws, and it is good to imitate them. For there was once a time when Moses alone administered judgment by himself, laboring from dawn until night. But afterward his father-in-law arrived, saw with what a weight of business he was burdened, with those bringing disputes constantly streaming in upon him, and gave him the excellent advice to choose successors, granting him some respite. Persuaded by what was said, for it was indeed advantageous, he chose the most highly approved men from the whole multitude and appointed them at once as both subordinates and judges, commanding that the greater cases be brought up to him. This ordinance the sacred books contain in written form, for the instruction of the rulers of every generation. First, so that they not reject counselors as though they alone were capable of overseeing everything, since Moses, all-wise and beloved of God, did not reject them. And second, so that they choose a second and a third in command, taking care not to neglect more urgent matters while wearing themselves out over trifles, since it is impossible for human nature to attend to everything at once. One of the examples has now been set out. The proof of the second must be fitted to it. I said that the cases of the humbler people carry great weight in judgment. Weak and humble are the widow, the orphan, and the resident alien. It is for these that the highest king must judge, he who has bound upon himself sovereignty over all things, since, according to Moses, God, the ruler of the universe, has not cast them out of his own administration of justice. For the Hierophant, hymning the virtues of him who is, speaks in this way, "The great and mighty God, who does not marvel at a person's face nor accept a bribe in giving judgment." Deut. 10:17-18, and he adds, "Judgment for whom? Not for satraps and tyrants who have bound upon themselves dominion over land and sea, but for the resident alien, the orphan, and the widow. For the alien, because he has made the very kinsmen who alone might naturally have been his allies into implacable enemies, by migrating toward truth and toward honoring the one worthy of honor, turning away from the mythical fictions and the plurality of rulers which his parents, grandparents, ancestors, and all who share the blood of those who founded this admirable colony held in esteem. For the orphan, because he has been deprived of father and mother, the natural helpers and champions, and left destitute of the one power that was necessary for his defense. For the widow, because she has lost the man who took over from her parents the care and protection of her. For a husband is to a wife what parents are to an unmarried girl. Indeed, almost the whole nation of the Jews stands, in comparison with all others everywhere, in the position of an orphan. For other peoples, when disasters not sent by God come upon them, are not at a loss for help, because of their intermingling with other nations who act in concert with them. But no one readily joins forces with this nation, since it lives by exceptional laws. Its people are of necessity solemn, since they are trained toward the utmost virtue. And solemnity is austere, and this the great mass of mankind shuns, because they prefer the way of pleasure. But nonetheless, Moses says that the ruler of the universe, to whom this nation has been allotted, always takes pity and compassion on its orphanhood and desolation. Because out of the whole human race it has been set apart as a kind of first fruits for the Maker and Father. The reason is the justice and virtues, fought over and prized, of the founders of the nation, which endure like immortal, ever-flourishing plants, bearing fruit that preserves and benefits their descendants in every way, even if these descendants themselves happen to go astray in ways that are curable rather than utterly incurable. Yet let no one, thinking that noble birth is a perfect good, grow careless of good actions on that account, reckoning that a person born of the best deserves greater anger if by wickedness of character he brings shame upon his parents. For having in his own family models of nobility to imitate, and turning away from none of them, he is culpable if he fails to set his life on a sound and upright course. The law forbids, with the most just of prohibitions, that anyone entrusted with the leadership and care of the community should walk deceitfully among the nation. For it is the act of a soul that is unfree and utterly servile to veil treacherous designs beneath a mask of hypocrisy. For a ruler must stand before his subjects as a father before his children, so that he too may be honored in return as by legitimate sons. Hence good rulers are, in truth, the common parents of cities and nations, showing an equal, sometimes even a greater, goodwill toward them. But those who wrap themselves in great power for the injury and harm of their subjects must be called not rulers, but enemies, since they act as implacable foes act. Moreover, those who do wrong by deceit are more wicked than those who oppose openly, if indeed it is easy to ward off those who lay bare their hostility without disguise, while the depravity of the others is hard to grasp and hard to hunt down, since, as on a stage, they put on a costume not their own to conceal their true appearance. This form of rule extends already, and has crept in, I might almost say, into every department of life, differing only in size and degree. For what a king is to a city, that a headman is to a village, and a master to a household, and a physician to the sick. A general is to an army what a captain is to a ship's marines and crew, and again, what a shipowner is to a cargo vessel, a pilot is to sailors. All of these have it in their power to do either well or worse, but they ought to will what is better, and what is better is to benefit, not to harm, all those it is in their power to help. For this is what it means to follow God, since he too has the power to do either, but wills only the good. This is shown by the creation and governance of the world. For he called what did not exist into being, bringing order out of disorder, qualities out of what had no qualities, likenesses out of unlike things, sameness out of things differing, community and harmony out of things without communion or concord, equality out of inequality, and light out of darkness. For it is always his concern, and that of his beneficent powers, to transform and remodel whatever is disordered in the inferior substance toward the better. This is what good rulers ought to imitate, if indeed they have any concern to be made like God. But since countless things slip away and escape the notice of the human mind, bound as it is to so great a crowd of the senses, quite capable of leading it astray and deceiving it with false opinions, or rather entombed within a mortal body, which one might properly call a tomb, let no judge be ashamed to admit that he does not know what he in fact does not know. For first, the one who lies will become worse than himself, having banished truth beyond the borders of his own soul. And second, he will do countless harm to those on trial, presenting a blind kind of knowledge because he does not see what is just. So then, whenever unclarity and great darkness dim his grasp of the matters at hand, let him decline to render judgment and refer the case to more accurate judges. And who might these be but the priests and the head and leader of the priests? For the true ministers of God have sharpened their understanding with care, holding that even the smallest fault is no small thing, because of the surpassing greatness in every respect of the King they serve. Which is why all who are consecrated as priests are commanded to offer sacrifice sober, so that no drug that creeps in to cause raving and delirium may dim the eyes of their understanding. And perhaps also because the priest who is a priest in truth is at once a prophet, having advanced to the service of him who truly is not so much by lineage as by virtue. And to a prophet, nothing is unknown, since he carries within himself an intelligible sun and rays that cast no shadow, granting the clearest apprehension of things invisible to sense but comprehensible to the mind. Again, the merchants, shopkeepers, and market traders who handle weights, scales, and measures, and all others who sell for a living the wares, dry or liquid, that people need, are set under the authority of market inspectors. But they ought, if they are prudent, to be rulers over themselves, doing what is just not out of fear, but by free choice. For everywhere a right action done of one's own free will is more honorable than one done under compulsion. Hence the law commands shopkeepers and merchants, and all others who have taken up such a way of life, to keep just scales, weights, and measures, contriving nothing to the harm of buyers, but speaking and acting in every matter from a free and guileless soul, reckoning that unjust gains are most harmful, while wealth gained with justice can never be taken away. And since wages are set as the rewards of diligent labor for craftsmen, and it is those in need, not those with abundant means, who do the work, the law commands that payments not be deferred, but that the agreed wage be given on the very day. For it is absurd that the wealthy should receive services from the poor, yet not render in return the payment due, when they themselves live in immediate abundance. Are these not clear proofs of a safeguard against greater wrongs? For he who does not allow even a wage that will certainly be paid to fall past its due time, fixing the deadline at evening, by which the laborer on going home must receive his payment, does not this same lawgiver, well before this, forbid robbery, theft, fraud on debts, and all things of that kind, shaping and molding the soul toward the approved form of true nobility? It is also well said elsewhere that no one should slander or speak ill of anyone, and above all not of the deaf, who can neither perceive that a wrong is being done to him nor defend himself in kind. For of all conflicts, the most lawless is one in which one party is put to the test in acting, and the other only in suffering. Those who abuse the speechless and those whose hearing is impaired commit a wrong like that of people who trip the blind or put other obstacles in their path. For of necessity, being unable through ignorance to step over them, they stumble on both counts, missing their way and injuring their feet. Against those who do such things and those who take delight in them, the law holds out the fear of God, fittingly and appropriately, since he alone stretches out his hand and shields those unable to help themselves. And he all but declares outright to wrongdoers, concerning those who have been wronged, O empty of understanding, do you think you will go unnoticed, treating their misfortunes as a laughing matter and sinning against them further? The very things that have befallen these people, their ears through revilings, their eyes through obstacles set in their path. But the God who watches over and oversees all things, you will never escape his notice, as you trample upon the misfortunes of wretched human beings, thinking you will not suffer the like fate, going about with a body exposed to every disease, and senses so precarious that, for a slight and chance cause, they are not merely dimmed but suffer incurable disablement. As for those who have forgotten themselves, who suppose they stand above the natural weakness common to all human beings and imagine they have escaped the hidden and unpredictable machinations of fortune, who has often hurled sudden thunderbolts, and upon people enjoying a fair voyage through life, has brought them down almost within the very harbor of happiness, why should such people boast and trample on the misfortunes of others, showing no reverence even for justice, who sits enthroned beside the ruler of all things, and to whom it is granted, with eyes sleepless and of the sharpest sight, to survey even what lies hidden in dark corners as though in the clear light of the sun? These people seem to me, out of an excess of cruelty, not even to spare the dead, but to use the common expression, would not hesitate to strike a corpse a second time, since they think it right to insult and outrage even parts of the body that are, in a sense, already dead before the rest. For eyes that no longer see and ears that no longer hear are themselves dead. So that even though these are parts belonging to a human being who has vanished from among the living, such people will display their pitilessness and implacability, doing nothing of that humane and sympathetic character which is preserved for the dead even by enemies in wars fought without any formal truce. So much, then, on this subject. Next he sets out, one after another in orderly sequence, a harmony of precepts of a similar kind, saying that cattle are not to be mated with those under a different yoke, that a vineyard is not to be sown with two different crops, and that a garment woven from two kinds of material, a fraudulent piece of work, is not to be worn. The first of these was stated among the laws against adultery, to give clearer emphasis to the principle that one must not lie in wait to ambush marriages that belong to others, corrupting both the characters of wives and the honest hopes attached to the begetting of legitimate children. For the one who has forbidden the mating of different species among irrational animals evidently works, from a distance, to check adultery. It must be spoken of again now in the discussion of justice, for where the same principle can be applied to a number of cases, it should not be passed over. It is just, then, to bring together things capable of sharing in common, and things of the same kind are naturally suited to partnership, since things of different kinds are, on the contrary, by nature unmixed and incapable of partnership. Whoever contrives unlawful unions among such things acts unjustly, doing away with a law of nature. But the truly sacred law has employed such great forethought for justice that it does not even permit the plowing of the earth by animals of unequal strength, but has forbidden yoking together an ass and a calf to plow, so that the weaker one, forced to compete against the excessive power of the stronger, should not be worn down and collapse beforehand. And yet the stronger animal, the bull, is listed among the clean animals, while the weaker one, the ass, is among the unclean. But even so, the law did not begrudge those thought to be inferior their share of the benefit that comes from justice, for the sake, I think, of the most necessary lesson for judges that they should never disadvantage the lowborn in their judgments. In matters where the examination concerns not lineage, but virtue or vice. Akin to these is also the last ordinance in this series of paired precepts, that one must not weave together substances of different kinds, wool and linen. For in these two, not only is their difference a barrier to partnership, but the dominance of one over the other, when they must be put to use, produces tearing rather than union. The middle precept of the triad of paired laws was that one must not sow a vineyard with a second crop. First, so that things belonging to a different kind should not become mixed together in confusion. For sown crops are not suited to trees, nor trees to sown crops. For this reason, nature has not fixed the same appointed time for both toward the production of their yearly fruit, but has assigned to the one the spring for the season of reaping, and to the other, the end of summer for the gathering of tree fruit. At any rate, it happens that at the same time some things wither after having flowered earlier, while others sprout after having withered earlier. For in winter, while the trees are shedding their leaves, the sown crops are in flower, and in spring, on the contrary, while the wild and cultivated timber of the trees is withering, the sown crops sprout. And it is very nearly the same boundary at which the fruits of the sown crops reach completion, and those of the trees take the beginning of their generation. It was fitting, then, that things so widely separated from one another, both in their natures and in their flowering and in the seasons appropriate to the generation of what belongs to them, should be kept apart and settled in separate places, bringing order out of disorder. For order is akin to the cosmos, and disorder to the uncosmic. Second, so that neither kind should suffer harm and inflict harm in turn upon the other, each drawing away the nourishment belonging to the other. For once this nourishment is split into fragments, as in famine and scarcity, all the plants alike will necessarily grow weak throughout, and either will become altogether barren from complete failure to bear, or, having grown weak beforehand from want, will never produce noble fruit. Third, so that the fertile earth should not be crushed under the heaviest burdens, on the one hand by the continuous and overlapping density of what is sown and grows in the same place, and on the other by the doubling of the yield of fruit. For it is enough for the owner to take one yearly tribute from a single piece of land, just as a king takes one from a city. But to attempt to collect several tributes is the work of excessive greed for money, by which even the ordinances of nature are overturned. For this reason, the law might say to those who have resolved to sow their vineyards out of greed for gain, "Do not become worse than kings who have subdued cities and territories by arms and campaigns, who, out of forethought for the future, and at the same time out of consideration for their subjects, think it right to collect a single yearly tribute, being on their guard against reducing them, in a short space of time, to utter and complete destitution. But if you exact from the same soil, in spring, the tribute of barley and wheat, and in summer the tribute of tree fruit, you will break its neck under a double burden. For it will fail you, in all likelihood, like an athlete who is not allowed to catch his breath and gather strength again for the beginning of a new contest. But you seem to forget with ease those provisions of mine made for the common good. For if you had remembered my institution concerning the seventh year, by which I judged it right that the sacred land should be released, worn out by none of the labors of farming, on account of the toils it had undergone over the 6 years, bearing fruit each year in its season according to the ordinances of nature, would you not, in youthful recklessness and grasping greed, have devised new sowings, planting even the land given to trees, and especially the vine-bearing land, with a second crop, so that you might, by a double and doubly unjust income each year, swell your estates through love of money, that lawless desire, hoarding up silver? For the very same person would not tolerate his own fields being left fallow in the seventh year without bringing in revenue, for the sake of restoring the exhausted land, and yet he burdens and oppresses it with a double load. It was necessary, then, for me to declare that the produce of such holdings, both the fruit of the orchard and the fruit of the sown crop, is unconsecrated and impure, because the life breath animating the fertile earth is, in a manner of speaking, throttled and strangled, and because the owner, in dealing with the gifts of God, does violence and runs riot, unleashing his unjust desires upon it without setting any limit or measure to them. Is it not worth falling in love with instructions of this kind, which from far off check and restrain the frenzy of human greed? For the private individual who has unlearned, in dealing with plants, the taking of unjust profit if he should lay hold of greater affairs and become a king will apply the same habit toward men and women alike, exacting no double tribute nor breaking the necks of his subjects with double levies. For the habit ingrained by long familiarity is enough to soften hard characters and, in a sense, to train and mold them toward better patterns, and the better patterns are those which the soul stamps with the seal of justice. These are the laws he lays down for each individual. But there are other, more general commands, which he proclaims in common to the whole nation, exhorting them as to how they must conduct themselves not only toward friends and allies, but also toward those who revolt from an alliance. For if, he says, they shut themselves up quickly within their walls and offer resistance, let your young men, well armed and equipped for war, march out, and having thrown a camp around the city in a circle, wait watchfully, granting nothing to anger in advance of reasoning, so that they may set about what must be done with greater firmness and steadiness. Let them then at once send heralds to invite them beforehand to a settlement, and at the same time to show the formidable strength of the arrayed force. And if, repenting of their recent uprising, they yield and turn toward peace, let them gladly accept the terms of truce. For peace, even if it is very costly, is more profitable than war. But if they persist in their madness, emboldened and relying also on the invincible alliance of justice, let the besiegers press their siege engines against the walls. And then, having broken open sections of them, let them charge in together in a mass. And, striking unerringly with their spears and cutting down without mercy, wheeling about with their swords, let them defend themselves by inflicting what these people intended to suffer, until they have laid low, man for man, the whole opposing army. Then, having taken the silver and gold and the rest of the spoil, let them set the city on fire, so that it may never again be able to recover its breath, rise up, and rebel, and also as a warning, to instill fear in neighboring peoples, since human beings are taught moderation by the sufferings of others. But let them release the young women and the wives, expecting them to suffer none of the violence that war inflicts, since they have been granted mercy on account of their natural weakness. From this, it is clear that the nation of the Jews is bound by treaty and friendly toward all who share the same disposition, and is peaceable in its intentions, yet not so contemptible as to yield, out of cowardice, to those who use force unjustly. But when it goes forth to defend itself, it distinguishes between those who live by treachery and those who do the opposite. For to slaughter indiscriminately, even those who have done the least wrong or none at all, I would call the mark of a savage and untamed soul. And to treat women as an addition to a war waged by men, women whose life is by nature peaceable and confined to the household, is likewise the mark of such a soul. He instills such a passion for justice in those who live under his constitution that he does not even allow the fruitful land of a hostile city to be ravaged by men cutting down its trees to destroy its produce. Why, he says, do you bear a grudge against things that have no soul, whose nature is gentle and which produce gentle fruits? Does a tree, my friend, display the hostility of an enemy at war, that in return for what it offers you it should be made ready to be torn up by its very roots? On the contrary, it does good, supplying the victors with an abundance of necessities and of the means to a life of comfort. For it is not men alone who pay tribute to their masters, but plants too, bringing their more useful produce according to the seasons of the year, without which life is not possible. But let there be no sparing of trees that are barren and unfruitful, and of all timber that grows wild, for those who wish to cut them for palisades and stakes and pointed stockades for trenches, and, when the need arises, for the construction of ladders and wooden siege towers. For it is to such uses, and others like them, that these trees might fittingly be put. So much, then, has been said concerning what pertains to justice. But justice itself, what poet or prose writer could worthily sing its praise, standing as it does above every commendation and every encomium? At any rate, one thing alone, the most venerable of its excellences, its noble birth, would be praise enough in itself, even if a person were to pass over everything else and remain silent. For equality, as those who have precisely studied nature have handed down to us, is the mother of justice. And equality is unshadowed light. The sun, if the truth must be told of the intelligible realm, since its opposite, inequality, in which there is the one who exceeds and the one who is exceeded, is the beginning and source of darkness. Equality has ordered well all things, both in heaven and on earth, by laws and ordinances that cannot be moved. For who does not know that days are measured against nights, and nights against days, by the sun, in an equality of proportionate intervals? The equinoxes that occur each year, called by the name of what happens at them, the spring equinox and the autumn equinox, nature has made so plain that even the most unmusical of people perceive the equality, in their magnitudes, of days against nights. And what of the moon's circuits, as it runs its double course from conjunction to full light and from fullness back to conjunction, are these not measured by an equality of intervals? For by as much and to whatever degree its waxings occur, by just so much and to the same degree do its wanings occur, in both aspects of its quantity, that of its number of days and that of its magnitude of light. And just as equality is honored above all in the purest of substances, heaven, so too it is honored in the neighboring element, air. For the year being divided into four parts called the seasons, the air by nature turns and changes in its turnings and changes, displaying an order that cannot be perceived amid what looks like disorder. For being distinguished by an equal number of months into winter and spring, summer and autumn, three to each season, it completes the year, which, just as its very name indicates, contains all things within itself as it comes full circle, and could not have accomplished this in any other way had it not apportioned itself according to the seasons of the year. Equality extends from the heavenly and celestial realms down to the things of earth, sending up on high the pure nature that belongs to itself, akin to the ether, while dispatching downward, like the sun's own radiance, to the earth, a second brightness. For whatever among our affairs is out of tune is the work of inequality, and whatever has the order that is fitting is the work of equality, which, in the substance of the universe, to speak in the most proper sense, is order itself. In cities it is the most law-abiding and best of constitutions, democracy, and again, in bodies it is health, and in souls it is nobility of character. for inequality, conversely, is the cause of diseases and of vices. Even the longest lived among us would run out of time were he to wish to recount all the praises of equality and of the justice it has begotten. For this reason, it seems better to me, content with what has been said, for the sake of stirring the memory of those who love learning, to leave the rest inscribed on their souls, as sacred images set in a most holy place.